This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
In the year 2000, the Albany Medical Center Prize for Medicine and Biomedical Research was established. Funded by the estate of the late philanthropist and businessman Morris Marty Silverman, the $500,000 prize is one of the largest prizes for medicine and medical research in the world.
DNA, however, is very boring and dull.
On today's Health Show, we'll hear from the two doctors who will share this year's prize.
We'll also learn about a condition called deep vein thrombosis and why it can be dangerous. And we'll hear how some health plans available in Massachusetts are trying to keep prices down and perhaps set an example for the rest of the country. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. There's a condition that starts in your legs that could cause serious damage to your heart or lungs. It's called deep vein thrombosis, and it's estimated that it causes about 300,000 deaths each year. Here to talk about DVT is Dr. Charles Abrams, professor of medicine and associate chief of the Hematology Oncology Division at the University of Pennsylvania. He is also secretary of the American Association of Hematology. We spoke recently, and I asked him to tell us about deep vein thrombosis.
We all need to form a blood clot whenever we cut ourselves so that we can form a plug that seals off a hole. But some people form a clot in the middle of a blood vessel where it shouldn't be. And sometimes the clot can get large enough that it blocks blood flow, preventing any blood from going past it and endangering various parts of our body. So that inappropriate location of a blood clot is called a thrombosis. And if it occurs in one of the deep veins, it means that it's occurring in one of the larger veins within our body, usually within our arms or legs. So a deep vein thrombosis is a blood clot where you don't want it, usually in a big vessel in your arm or your leg.
And what exactly causes this? Do we know that yet?
Well, we know a lot, and many times we can give our best guess as to what caused it. And usually it's a combination of events, a combination of genetic, perhaps behavioral, as well as environmental risk factors. And so we know that there are a lot of things that increase our risk for developing blood clots. So, for example, every year we get older, our risk of developing a blood clot increases. Well, there's not much we can do about that. And there are families of people that have inherited genes that predispose them to develop blood clots. And again, there's not much you can do about that. But there are things that we can do things about. So, for example, being overweight, that can increase your chances of getting a blood clot. Having long periods of inactivity that decreases blood flow, long airplane flights, being confined for other reasons, that will increase your risk of having a blood clot. Cancer, surgery, pregnancy, all these things together can increase your risk of developing a blood clot. And so overall, we can usually say why someone had a blood clot about half of the time, and the other half of the time it's just people walking down the street who suddenly feel a pain in their arm or their leg.
Now, we understand having a blood clot can't be a good thing, but that in itself is not a problem. Why does this become deadly?
Well, you raise a very good point, Bob. You know, this is actually, I think, an under-recognized national health epidemic. There are probably 500,000 people a year that develop one of these deep vein thromboses, and perhaps 60 to maybe even 100,000 people a year who die of a blood clot. And so if you think of the number of people who die of breast cancer, the number of people who die of motor vehicle accidents, and then you add that number to the number of people who die of AIDS, all those together aren't as many deaths per year as the number of people who die of inappropriate blood clots. And Bob, you're right. The clot in the leg or the clot in your arm probably isn't going to kill you. But what can kill you is if a piece of that clot breaks off, floats through the bloodstream, ends up in your lungs. It can ultimately lead to your heart being unable to pump blood past your lungs, and that can be quite deadly. And so we call that phenomenon a pulmonary embolism, and probably 30% of people who develop a pulmonary embolism will die from it unless they get treatment.
Are there symptoms? How do you know that you might have this?
Well, if it's a clot in your arm or your leg, you might complain of swelling in that particular arm or leg. You might have pain or tenderness or maybe even heaviness in that leg, maybe even only when you're standing or walking or using that arm. You might have a feeling of increased warmth in that limb, in that leg, particularly in the area where it's swollen. You might notice it's sort of red there. And those would all be signs of a deep vein thrombosis in either your arm or your leg. Now, if a piece of it were to break off and end up in your lungs, this pulmonary embolism that we talked about, then you might have sudden shortness of breath. You might have pain in your chest, especially when you're taking a deep breath. You might have a cough, or you might feel lightheaded. All these things together are sort of warning signs that suggest you should seek medical attention, probably immediately.
It's interesting. Now, how can a doctor or how can somebody find out? Are there tests for this, or is it just, you know, you have to take an ultrasound on somebody? How do you do that?
Well, you're right again. Your doctor will ask you questions about your medical history and probably perform a physical examination. There's a blood test that's actually pretty simple. It's also rather good at diagnosing blood clots, and it's called a D-dimer test. And so your doctor may order that particular blood test. If there's a suspicion that you have a clot in your arm or your leg, an ultrasound is often done to look to see if there's a point in one of your veins where the blood can no longer flow past it. If the doctor or you suspect that you actually have a pulmonary embolism where the clot has broken off and ended up in your lungs, there are a variety of tests that can be done for that as well, although the most common one is a type of CAT scan, what's called a spiral CT scan that can be done of your chest. That's also very good at detecting blood clots, both large and small.
Is the only way to, if you find you do have one, is the only way to get it and just to go in and get it, or can they be dissolved with drugs? What's the treatment?
You know, the real tragedy of this is that I mentioned that a lot of people die of this, but most of those people who die never got medical attention for one reason or another. If you were to actually get treated for this, and the treatment for it is usually blood thinners, although there are a variety of different types of treatments out there, but if you were to get treatment with a blood thinner, your risk of dying from this, it goes down dramatically, probably 15-fold or greater. And so the treatments are actually quite good. The problem is getting the word out, and that's what I'm trying to do here today, along with the American Society of Hematology.
Well, let's talk about prevention. Are there things you can do to make sure or at least cut your risk of getting one of these?
If you've never had a deep vein clot before, there are things that you can do. You should probably exercise. You should get up and walk frequently around to make sure you're not very immobile. You know, one of your colleagues, David Bloom, he was an NBC reporter who was reporting from the war in the Middle East, developed a pulmonary embolism while he was sort of confined in one of these small tanks. And so getting up and moving around is a very important thing to do. Having a discussion with your doctor, asking him, what is my risk, and following your doctor's recommendations, I think are all things that you can do to help prevent blood clots. If you've already had one, then you should take your medications, you should take your blood thinners, keep your appointments, and follow up with your doctor's instructions.
I remember hearing it's the type of thing where if you're on a long plane flight, you should either get up and walk around or just move your legs, do some exercises just to, you know, keep things flowing.
That's absolutely true. And so the risk of developing a clot on a plane flight is real, although it's very small. But there's no question that if you get up and move around and do some squats and try to squeeze your arms and your legs as much as you can, you'll minimize your chance of developing one of these clots.
Dr. Charles Abrams is a professor of medicine and associate chief of the Hematology Oncology Division at the University of Pennsylvania. He is also secretary of the American Association of Hematology. Still to come, there's a move in Massachusetts to pay doctors for how they do rather than what they do. That story's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1254.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
As much as some politicians might not like to admit it, the state of Massachusetts has become a working model for the national health care reform law. Now there are many in the state looking at plans that are designed to lower costs. The Health Show's Lucas Willard reports.
Since 2009, over 1.2 million Massachusetts residents have signed on to what's known as global payment health care plans. The increasingly popular health insurance option is aimed at lowering premium prices by changing how doctors are paid. Global payment plans are not your standard fee-for-payment service. In the traditional method, patients would receive bills with separate fees for each service provided, including x-rays, tests, doctor visits, etc. Global payment plans instead force health service providers to stick to a budget, emphasizing quality of care, not quantity. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick endorsed this idea as he called for legislators to help stop rising insurance costs.
Slowing the rate of increase is critical, but unless that slowdown is sustained, healthcare costs will continue to squeeze everything else, including job growth itself. We need to put an end to the fee-for-service model. We need to stop paying for the amount of care and start paying instead for the quality of care.
The governor said in his address that the rate of health insurance cost increases have shifted from 16.3% growth 2 years ago to just 2.3% growth today. Blue Cross Blue Shield's Alternative Quality Care Program, or AQC, is one such global payment plan that adjusts payment rates for each patient based on health status, age, and gender. Because doctors under the plan are required to work on a budget, unnecessary repeat tests and evaluations are discouraged, and more preventative care is valued. Patients are more likely to be contacted for checkups and routine treatments to avoid costly hospital stays. The idea is then to pass the savings from prevention programs back to the patient. Blue Cross found last year that doctors in its HMOs paid through a budgeted plan provided better care than doctors receiving payments the traditional way. Massachusetts' three largest health insurance companies, Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, Tufts Health Plan, and Fallon Community Health, are also offering global payment plans. Healthcare for All is a consumer advocacy group focused on improving the quality of healthcare in Massachusetts. Research Director Brian Rossman says that while the organization is pleased with the way the market is shifting towards global payment plans, he encourages the state legislature to draft consumer protection regulations.
And we think it's absolutely critical that the state step in to make sure that the savings get shared with the policy buyers, like the people who purchase health care, so the savings go back to us. And so to make sure that patients have a way of making sure they get all the care they need. There's a danger with these plans. If not done right, this could end up to be rationing and capitation. If done well, however, we think there's a real opportunity to move the care into more health, more wellness, more prevention, and really allow doctors and nurses and hospitals to focus on keeping the patient healthy.
Currently, both the State House and Senate are in the process of developing consumer protection and government oversight laws for the plans. Healthcare for All is hoping the regulations will be ready and passed by this spring. I'm Lucas Willard.
I'm going back to Massachusetts.
The Albany Medical Center Prize in Medicine and Biomedical Research is, monetarily at least, the biggest award of its kind in the United States, and second only to the Nobel Prize around the world. The winners of this year's prize, which will be officially awarded May 11th, have just been announced. Dr. James Darnell, Jr. and Dr. Robert Rader of the Rockefeller University in New York City will share this year's award. Both men are being honored for their work to unlock the secrets of DNA and RNA processing, which is how cells express their genetic information. The Health Show's Brian Shields spoke with both men about their work, beginning with Dr. Darnell.
Everybody in the public these days who's paying attention knows about DNA. DNA, however, is very boring and dull. I'm halfway joking. The reason it is it contains all the information that is needed to pass genetically from one generation to the next, but the information is locked up in a way that you have to get it out as books are taken out of the library. And what our early work did was to show how in our cells, that is to say animal cells, the RNA is a copy of the DNA, and we discovered that several kinds of RNA are copied. But in every case, the long string of RNA that's first copied has to be cut, and in some cases put back together, and then used to explain the directions from DNA in a usable fashion out in the cell cytoplasm. In our cells, all this goes on in the nucleus, and then the information is used in the cytoplasm. So that's what we were up to in the early 1960s. And the three kinds of RNA were what Bob came along and showed the world how to copy.
Dr. Rader, your graduate work some 43 years ago tapped into this gene transcription in animal cells. Can you tell us a bit more about that? You were just a graduate student, but back then, did you realize you were onto something pretty big?
Did you have to mention 43 years ago? Yes, Dr. Darnell alluded to this. So basically, my question was, how do you copy the DNA to make the RNA that Dr. Darnell was studying, of which there are sort of three major classes, the messenger RNA, large ribosomal RNAs, the big factory where the messenger RNA is translated, and then small adapter RNAs that link specific amino acids to a specific code in the RNA. So I was basically looking for an enzyme or enzymes that did this and discovered that there were not one, as there is in a bacterial cell, which copies the genes for all types of RNAs, but there are three, so there's a division of labor. They were called RNA polymerases 1, 2, and 3, and they were later ascribed functions in the synthesis of the major classes of RNA. And to be sure, that was probably the most exciting scientific moment of my life, because this was basically in the dark ages when, in animal cells at least, nothing was really known about the enzymology of what we call transcription, copying the DNA.
In a statement from Albany Medical Center, the president and chief executive officer, James Barber, said the work that you two men have done have allowed scientists and physicians to explore new ways to fight disease, including viruses, heart disease, anemia, autoimmune. Did you ever think that when you were tapping into this 40, 50 years ago that it would be such a big deal?
Well, that's a bit of an expansive statement, but there is certainly a grain of truth. Let me give you at least a 30-second background. Once we knew through Bob's enzymes and the cutting and splicing that was necessary to deliver messages to the cytoplasm, I was interested, as I had been from my postdoctoral days, and how different cells make different kinds of proteins. And there are proteins that sit on specific sites in DNA and cause them to attract one of Bob's enzymes, polymerase 2, and make the messenger RNA. What we studied in the 80s, and then the thing that intersects with medicine, finally wrestled to the ground in 1992, and two or three years after that, were transcription factors that sit on DNA and say, copy me, please. And then RNA polymerase 2 does so. And these factors are triggered to become active in the cell by things that bind to the cell surface, such as interferon, which you've probably heard of, and erythropoietin, which 70,000 people have to take once a month to keep their red blood cells up, and another whole group of things called cytokines, operate by activating one of the transcription factors that we uncovered called the STATs. And so many, many areas of inflammation and virus response and successful virus defeat come through this agency of the STATs. and the intersection with medicine that I'm still hoping to see completed before I drift off is that one of these stats, stat 3, is one of the most prominent overactive, impermissibly active proteins in cancer cells. And the laboratories throughout the world, but not, I believe, enough of them, are trying to find inhibitors, compounds that will enter cells and inhibit STAT3, because I believe that will be a prominent way to go after cancer.
Dr. Rader, as Dr. Darnell noted, anyone who's paying attention has heard of DNA, but DNA, at least in the popular culture, is considered a crime-fighting, a law enforcement issue. Where do you see this RNA, DNA research going in the future? As a pioneer in this field, along with Dr. Darnell, where do you see the young people, the young researchers going in this field?
Well, I think they still have to figure out the whole issue of gene regulation. Now, Dr. Darnell mentioned gene-specific and cell-specific inducible transcription factors, and there are several thousand of those, and they are all induced in various signaling pathways that were mentioned, but how they actually work is a very complicated matter. They interface with literally dozens and dozens of other proteins, transcription cofactors that are necessary to actually activate these enzymes that were described on specific genes. So there are many signaling pathways, and the circuitry of all of this, in my view, there are a couple of major problems in diverse ends of the pathway. One is the circuitry, the feedback loops, the feed-forward loops of how all of these things are regulating a given set of genes, so they proceed in one pathway of development or cell differentiation. The other extreme has really to do with biophysical analysis, structural biology, which many people work on, to look at the details of how proteins interact, and particularly these complex machineries, which a given gene, when it's activated, will have at least 100 different polypeptides sitting on it that is part of this machinery we've described in the gene-specific factor. So there's a lot of work there to potentially do drug designs. Dr. Darnell is interested in some of this himself, as he alluded to, between a transcription factor and a cofactor. So I'd say, you know, there are going to be therapeutic applications, but just understanding the circuitry of how all of these factors operate, because some of them are redundant. There's not just a single transcription factor for a single one of the 25,000 genes that are activated. There are a few thousand factors that have to be utilized in various combinations for 25,000 genes or however many there are. So there's a huge circuitry that has to be worked out. So I think just understanding still the basic principles of how genes are regulated, understanding them in different physiological pathways, of which there are many, of course, different cells, different cell types, and then figuring out how they're misregulated in developmental abnormalities, cancer, and so forth. A lot to do.
Dr. James Darnell Jr. and Dr. Robert Rader of the Rockefeller University in New York City are this year's winners of the Albany Medical Center Prize for Medicine and Biomedical Research. The prize will be awarded on May 11th.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.